Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 93, recorded March 6th, 2013. Poe Bronson. Triangulation is brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get the most interesting, smartest, most thoughtful, best spoken, or sometimes just best looking people on the internet in, and get to talk to them about what they're up to. And our guest today is all of the above. Poe Bronson is here. Started as a novelist. You might have read Bombardier, which I loved. The Nudist on the Late Shift, which I loved. The first $20 million is the hardest.
Yep.
And then you became a journalist.
I'd started out making stuff up. But for first 20 minutes, always the hardest. I was doing a lot of Silicon Valley interviewing of different engineers and marketing people who were trying to become engineers,
right.
and chip designers. And I was interested in the profile of tech people who were trying to invent something great, who were in a marketing system that didn't want to shoot for that kind of great. They just wanted to give something kind of more mediocre out there that they could sell.
Right.
And I thought that was a really interesting personality dilemma for someone to be in.
So it really was journalism. It was almost a romanza clef where you were
right.
telling a story that was true, but in a fictional...
Right. This whole story was made up, though people thought of that as a romanza clef.
It really
right?
felt that way, I have
but,
to say.
But it was based on this time I spent with these
right.
different guys.
Right.
And then I was like, what am I going to do? And two things were going on. One was I started to feel, Leo, like I was kind of cannibalizing the most recent thing I had just researched and learned. And that as a novelist, I needed to be free to go out there and learn more of the world.
Oh.
I needed I couldn't fabricate the world unless I knew the world.
Right.
I only knew a narrow slice,
right?
I had grown up in Seattle. I'd come to Stanford.
You went to Lakeside School, same school as Bill Gates.
And I dated his little sister in seventh grade, and she was my classmate. And
first kiss?
And... maybe for me. No, actually, it was Libby's friend, Ann Leonard, who was probably my first kid. And I was 10 years behind him at Lakeside.
Wow.
And
that's cool.
I took the Caltech transfer exam one day in school, just like he had, and I got the highest score, except for his first time highest
wow.
score on that
was,
thing.
He wasn't a legend, but I guess he might have been.
He was.
By then.
He had just moved back from Albuquerque.
Right.
And he spoke at my high school graduation.
Oh, that's neat.
Now, I'm going to go further on this. People don't know this, but. And then the word got out. When he was there, he wanted to know who had done really well on the Caltech transfer exam that year and who was on the math team. And he said, we could offer him jobs like copying floppy disks. So it just wasn't personal to me, but it was passed to me that day at graduation that if I wanted a summer job,
you could always copy floppies for Microsoft.
I could copy floppies for Microsoft. And my friend did it, Lloyd Frank, who went on to run Microsoft Europe and Expedia.
Wow.
I think.
Turned out to be a good job.
And my dad told me I could make more money with the tips at the restaurant where I already had a restaurant.
Dad, so. Do you ever go back and say, Dad, you were wrong?
No, we don't talk about that. We've both made a lot of mistakes in life.
That's the best way, don't you think?
It is.
I'm sure you have no regrets about choosing that. What if I mean,
I honestly do a lot of the time. It's not that I have regrets. I mean, it's like I wish I had a second life, and I do find myself at times thinking, did I make a mistake? Should I have gone the other direction? And
no, I'm going to tell you right now. No.
Thank you for that. Because one of those nights was 4 o'clock in the morning last night,
yeah.
And I was finding myself wondering
about first
that.
Of all, anything that happens at 4 o'clock in the morning, just throw that right out.
I was in Seattle last night, and so...
The hour of the wolf,
yeah.
Jung called that. Because, I don't know, somebody once told me, oh, it's just your blood sugar's low, but it's the worst thoughts in the world at 4 a.m. I don't know, when you wake up at 4, that's it. You don't throw that stuff out. And I'll tell you why you made the right choice. And I know this because I often thought maybe I should have gone into technology. Here I am watching a ringside seat
yeah.
from the late 70s to now watching everybody go on to billionaires and doing great. And I was always thinking, I should start a company. What am I doing? You know, I'm watching the revolution instead of making it.
Right.
And I tried it once. I was about 30. I thought, I'm getting out of there. I'm gonna, and it was horrible. Yeah. 6 months later, I said, I'm coming. I'd rather cover it. Much better being a journalist because you get to dabble in a lot of different things. It's back to that story you were talking about. Instead of just being focused on one thing.
I wanted to spread my energy.
Exactly.
Explore. Need a lot of novelty, need a lot of the risk, and need a lot of independence.
Guess what? If you'd gotten a job at Microsoft, you wouldn't have any of that.
I certainly wouldn't have had that kind of independence. You know, yeah. I write in the newest book that we all have a desire to belong. We also have a desire not to be controlled by others.
Precisely.
And it doesn't take too much to go in one direction or the other to kind of have a quite different personality. And I definitely have that don't want to be controlled by others type thing.
Yeah. So you started, you went to Stanford, obviously very bright. Math student at Stanford?
Econ.
Yeah. Close enough.
Yeah.
And became a bond trader.
Yeah, I was a bond salesman for First Boston in the
80s. Yeah.
And my first jobs as a journalist, I left that to cover local politics.
Interesting.
And for San Francisco politics for local newsletters and newspapers.
So it was in the late 80s, early 90s?
It was during the Feinstein had passed. It was during the Agnos administration.
Oh, yeah.
And then Frank Jordan came in.
Yeah.
That was my sort of day job. And at night, I was going to San Francisco State and trying to be a fiction writer, trying to be a great novelist. And finally, I turned back to my years at First Boston as the kernel of experience to write Bombardiers, the dark satire of high finance.
Wonderful. And if my memory serves, it was a breakout novel. People said Poe Bronson's the next great thing, right? It was huge.
That was my memory of it.
Yeah.
So a few people said that.
No, it was huge. Yeah. And everybody said, who is this guy? Where did he come from? He's so young. The brilliant novel. So you got some good reinforcement.
Yeah, but then I decided to leave the fiction behind. I decided I needed to explore the world more, turn to journalism, get assignments from magazines to go places. I wrote for Wired and Times Magazine.
Great stuff for Wired.
Covering Silicon Valley for
years. But what fun is that? And you're in the 90s, during the heyday of the first dot-com bubble, covering all this stuff. It's exciting.
It was really fun. And I mean, I was like, I liked to drive down there and sleep in my Jetta. And I got a lot of access to things where I was just writing. I wasn't writing a business story per se. I was writing about what life was like for people in that period of time, whether it was the parties, whether it was, I was one of the first journalists to be allowed to actually write in print. But going along on through the whole IPO process and write about that.
Right.
And
which
it had
company?
To find, it was actually, it had to be a boring company, right? So nobody who was taking a big risk was going to let a journalist in.
Right.
And we identified Actuate, and Nico Nierenberg was the CEO at the time. And it was there out of Foster City. And basically, we came into a meeting, and Jim Breyer was the VC. And he said, right in front of everybody, he says, from your company's point of view, there's no good reason you should have Poe here. But he said, but he wrote Bombardiers. It's one of the greatest novels ever. You'll be lucky to have him tell your story. And then to let me
There's
in.
No upside to the company to having somebody in. But I tell you, for us, it's great.
Yeah.
Because we don't ever get to see all of this.
Don't even see all those.
The road show and the raising the cap. I mean, this is huge stuff and fascinating.
I got to write that for Forbes.
And
so that was great. And slowly have tried to move on to new topics with each book.
Well, I like your new focus, which is about, it's really, I don't know if I could encapsulate it. Maybe it's about how we work, performance. You wrote about successful people.
Yeah.
Then you wrote, our first interview was with your co-author, Ashley Merriman, a couple of years ago, because you guys wrote a book about children, about raising children.
Nurture Shock.
Was that because you had kids?
Yeah, that was pretty much, it was random how that came about. You had to look for the right opportunity, right? Ashley and I had been blogging together, picked up by Time. We were writing back page essays for Time. I got an assignment for New York Magazine to write about the science of ambition. And I was building this massive, big research story on the science of ambition. Yeah. I was interviewing YPOs and entrepreneurs and politicians and artists and trying to write this story. And it was becoming a monster of a story. And there was a piece in there about kids and how ambition is formed in kids.
Right.
And we wrote that for New York Magazine. So we'll just get this out of the story. Write that and then get back to the science of ambition. That story became the most successful story in the history of New York Magazine. 5 years later, it was 5 years ago last month that it was published. And even last week, it was on the most emailed.
No.
5 years later.
Well, because everybody wants to know how to make their, how to help their kids succeed.
Right.
I mean, yeah. that's if you're a parent, that's all you really are thinking about.
Well, and this new book was sort of a legacy of that one.
Well, this is about ambition. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, let's talk about the new book. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. What makes some people succeed, others not succeed, and what you could do that would help you become more successful.
Yeah.
But before we go on, I want to thank our sponsor, Pond5. You've heard about Pond5, the ultimate stock media marketplace. And I use the word marketplace because it's not just for people who buy stock photos, stock illustrations, music, sound effects. It's also for people who make it. And I think that's really an important thing for both sides. So if you are a photographer or a videographer, if you do After Effects templates or 3D models, if you do sound effects, music, you should check out Pond5 as a great place to sell your stuff. They pay the highest royalty rate in the business, 50%, and you set the price. So you say exactly what you want for your stock media. And as a Pond5 customer, that should make you feel good. You know that the people who create these illustrations, these photos, these videos are getting well taken care of. So it's a great transaction. And look at the choice. 1.4 million videos, 8.2 million photos, and hundreds of thousands new ones all the time. 753,000 illustrations, sound effects and music tracks, perfect for your podcast, 377,000. They've got 3D models, about 868 of those, 3,000 After Effects templates. And by the way, click the After Effects templates there, John, because what's cool about these is they're done. You just add your text. So it really is a great way to add some very nice shine to your next video. Look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Now, what's cool about this is you open up in After Effects, and all you do is you add your text, and it's yours. One of the things Pond5 also does is they offer a free video every week, a free stock video that you can use all the time. All of this stuff is royalty-free. That means you pay for it once, and you can use it in any medium in any form. Here's the free stock media clip right now. Oh, that's good. Use that in your PowerPoint to hypnotize the audience. What is that? It's a swirly hypnotic geometry. Oh, whoa. You are getting sleepy. Buy Pond5. You are getting... Actually, you don't have to buy anything. If you go to pond5.com/triangulation right now, you can get 50 free stock media files. Add that to the swirly whirlies. 50 of them yours to keep for anything you want to do in the future. The advantage of doing this is you'll have a Pond5 account. You get an experience of what it's like to browse the collection, what it is to download these, how you might use these. And I think they're smart. They now know that the next time you want some media, you know, as little as $5 for a photo illustration, $20 for videos, you'll have what you need. You'll know where to go. Pond5.com/triangulation. Get your 50 free stock media files today. We thank Pond5 for their support of Triangulation. Our guest, Poe Bronson, he and Ashley Merriman, the authors of a brand new book. This just came out a couple of weeks ago. Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And, you know, I could just pick each chapter title and say, okay, tell me.
Right. You could drop the book on the floor.
Yeah. Like, why women need even odds and men don't. But we'll hold that thought. So you're doing research on ambition.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of what led to this, right?
Right. Yeah, it was. And part of it was you mentioned how people really want to help their kids. And what they want is to instill work ethic in their kids.
Right.
They want kids to learn that when they're challenged, not to shrink from that challenge, but to turn the dial the effort knob up to 11 as a, you know, being challenged gets more and more tougher and competitive.
Well, and for a kid, you can really see how this is counterintuitive. The normal thing is, well, I'll just do the easy thing.
Right.
I'll just take it easy. Nobody wants to work hard.
Right.
And to teach a kid that it's better to do the hard thing first,
yeah,
is very counterintuitive.
Oh, and we have these kids who they're little. And we want to protect them, and we want to give them some safety.
Right.
And then we know out there in the future,
life ain't going to be like that.
There's India and China and,
yeah,
a billion people that we have to,
yeah,
compete with. And we have to get them from this non-competitive mindset to become competitors down the road. And I was interested in that. And I felt like what we had written in Nurture Shock was being used. People were saying this achieved that. And I,
right,
felt like it didn't. I felt like there was a lot more there that is these hidden factors that are affecting performance, goal motivation, goal realization, things affecting risk taking, entrepreneurship that people hadn't discovered and discussed that science before.
What do you use as the source for this? Is it psychological? There's a lot of, you quote a lot of psychological studies.
Psych studies, business school studies, mm-hmm. military school studies, education science, genetics, endocrinology, biology, physiology, econometric studies, sports. There's sports in every chapter because
right.
there's a
that's where competition
they
lives.
Like to find the data in sports
right.
that parallels a real life situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you talk in fact about the well known fact that being the home team is an advantage, but you say it's actually an advantage in a lot of
yeah. So
areas.
It was interesting because obviously we see that in sports,
right.
the most obvious one, but in Italy. Their soccer leagues and a lot of their soccer teams, for a variety of reasons, have had to play sometimes an entire season, sometimes games, without any fans.
Oh.
And yet they still win.
Hmm.
So the fans might help, but it's not the fans that's the home field advantage. Then you see, in the United States especially, teams switch to new arenas or new stadiums, and they don't have the home field advantage for the first year or two. Even though they have all of the fans again, and they're not traveling, they're at home. So what is going on? And what the scholars have come to believe is that there's this deep, deep primitive instinct of territorialism, which comes to play in home field advantage, and then it can be used. And this, they try
my house. You don't beat me in my house.
Right, well, I'm here in your house today.
Yeah.
And so they try to do these studies. They don't know what they're going to find. They have people come in and they're going to do a negotiation, like in business schools, do a lot of negotiation tasks. And they have one person get there 15 minutes early, hang up some posters, you know, make it look like
make
it's
it
their
turf.
Office, but they just were there 15 minutes
wow.
earlier. And then they come out of those negotiations with like 160% more of their terms met than they would otherwise.
Holy cow.
And
so it's more than just it's my house. It's also the other guy has to feel like I'm in their house.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
It's demoralizing the other guy.
The other guy needs to feel like, so if you've got a meeting and you're going to meet at Starbucks, get there first. If you're going to have a meeting in your company,
wow.
who's going to host the meeting? Say, we'll get the bagels and the coffee, have it in your conference room. They even see it in video games. People who enter video game rooms up to 10 seconds before the next player I have a
holy
much
cow.
Higher, like just like an NBA basketball team has a 63% chance of winning that home, you know, at home. They'll in video games, two virtual people, one there 10 seconds before the other, will have that 63% chance of winning.
That's a huge difference.
50-50. It's significant. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but it, you know what? Intuitively, it kind of makes sense because I was here, even if it was only a few seconds, you came into my house.
Right.
Wow. That
we don't
amazing.
Know what causes it. I mean, my guess is it's probably something about testosterone because enough studies show that there is a slight elevated testosterone increase on home field.
You talk about chess and testosterone. You wouldn't think that testosterone would have much to do with chess.
Right.
But it does.
It's shocking. So people know, obviously, with testosterone, you think of muscles, right?
Right.
You think of it as a
right.
male.
Aggression.
Just to be clear, the science of testosterone, it's its effect on the mind, not just on the body, right? And first of all, it's important to know that women and men both get increases in testosterone over baseline.
Oh, so, that's interesting. So it's not right. just men.
It's not your baseline testosterone. It's how your testosterone fluctuates
Got
in
it.
Response to moment-to-moment motivation and moment-to-moment
Got
challenge.
It.
And so they would do these studies, first of all, with face surgeons, and they would see that men 40 to 60 years old whose testosterone has lowered, their baseline testosterone, will get the night before a significant crucial surgery a 500% increase in testosterone.
They gear up.
They're,
unconsciously.
They get up for it because
yeah.
unconsciously because they know they've got a very stressful, important
wow.
surgery next day. So they took that idea and they looked at chess tournaments. And again, this is on the mind. You would think that testosterone is going to make you an irrational, overly aggressive risk taker. Right.
right. Chess is about thinking.
Right. And it makes them play better. Those who get the increase in baseline testosterone win out the tournament.
In fact, you could predict the results of the tournament before the tournament just by measuring the testosterone.
That's exactly what Booth, the scholar, had done. You could
That's
look at the baseline.
Mind-boggling.
You could tell who's going to win because you can
wow.
tell who's really showed up that day.
Not by and you even in his test, it's not by rating. I mean, you could normally say, well, this guy's better than that guy. He should win.
Right.
And it's not. This guy will lose to the lower-rated player if his testosterone wasn't bumped up.
Right, because you have a highly rated player who goes in overconfident.
Right.
Not, and so because
that explains a lot. You can, that happens in football too.
Right.
You figure, oh, we're going to beat this team, and you lose by 50 points because you didn't gear up for it.
Right. It's, people don't realize how that important that gearing up for it and correct response is.
Wow. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
But I can tell you some other strange things about testosterone.
Yeah.
So the other strange thing about testosterone is, again, what we think of it. And we think of it as the turns you into the Credible Hulk and all that muscle and all that rage. So they did this both with women coming to the lab playing a money game where you could share or cooperate. They also did this with college soccer players, and they measured baseline testosterone.
Right.
Turns out that the hormone of competition is testosterone. The hormone of collaboration is testosterone. Increased testosterone makes you collaborate with other people up until the point at which you see somebody violate the rules of fair play.
Oh.
Then you become enraged.
Right.
So testosterone actually makes you more cooperative until you see the rules broken.
Yeah.
Then you get angry.
John Harbaugh. That's all I have to say. It was holding! Sometimes it hurts and sometimes it helps perform in front of an audience.
Yeah, so
this is a great one.
You know, when people who maybe grew up playing tennis or ice skaters, they remember that feeling of like, oh, my dad's in the audience today.
Right.
And so some people, like, they love to have their dad in the audience or their mom or a fans, and some people hate it.
Right.
It makes them self-conscious. It makes them more aware. It adds to the level of pressure. So this was a scientific riddle they couldn't really figure out. Why does it help some people and hurt others? And what they eventually realized was that if you're just learning something or you have just learned something, to have an audience is detrimental to performance.
Yeah.
Right? You're not ready for the attention of the audience and the increased arousal.
But it makes sense if you're good at it.
But if you're good at it, it increases everything. It increases your heart rate, increases vasodilation, increases oxygenation of the blood. The neural networks of fear get suppressed. The neural networks of reward get juiced up. You get into this performance state, and it really helps you.
That makes it's intuitive. That makes perfect sense.
Right.
It kind of makes me think that if you want to be as good as you can be, you need to be challenged, right?
Absolutely.
Is that accurate?
So, we have this idea in the zeitgeist right now, which is, and Ashley and I both have worked with Dan Pink before, just to attach this idea to him better or worse, which is this notion that we want intrinsic drive in people. And what you want to do if you want to build a company these days is just hire ambitious, motivated, talented people who are driven, and don't manipulate them with checking on them all the time. Turn them loose. Don't try to manipulate them with financial rewards and that kind of thing. Just let them do their job.
Right. Get out of the way.
So the science actually says a couple things about that. One is that that is what they call bounded by its own effectiveness, which means it's a fancy way of saying it works when it works and sometimes it doesn't work. And the main thing is that if you can hire people like that, great. But
you can't always get people like that.
People like that tend not to be attracted to that kind of work environment.
Right.
They want to be rewarded for what they accomplish.
Right.
Yeah. So you kind of can't play that idea too far. But the other part of it is that no matter how driven you are by yourself, how much you push yourself, if you're forced to compete, you will push yourself even farther.
You do better.
And this goes back to 100 years of social science on this. Norman Triplett was a guy who, when chain-driven bicycles were invented with pneumatic tires. The car was invented but hadn't been popularized. And everyone was interested in, like, who can race their bike the fastest? And how do you do it? Is pushing yourself as hard as you possibly can on that bike? Do you go faster on your own or faster racing? And they found that racing always taps into hidden reserves of effort. And that's why competition is such a good thing. It just like in Darwin, competition among species led to the great diversity of finches.
Right.
You know, you get innovation out of competition. You don't get people in response to competition don't all become the same. They become more and more different. And you get breadth of ideas. You also get increased effort, hidden reserves of effort that people did not think that they had.
It makes sense. But you then see companies take this to the nth degree where they have I can't remember the name of it, but a couple of GE does this where they'll take the team and say, okay, you've got to rate everybody else, and one of you
10% of the workforce is supposed to be fired every year,
get kicked off the island.
Yeah.
That's a little too much stress, or is that a, do you think that's a successful way?
Well, they know their people more.
Right.
I, you know, my reading of the science looks at that and says that's probably high. You could probably, you know, fire 3 or 5% of people
every
year.
The Navy SEALs do that in their training. They say you got to pick the best guy on the team and the worst guy on the team.
Yeah. The Navy SEALs basic underwater demolition training is has an 83% failure rate.
Yeah.
So when everybody's failing, it's okay. But when you're, like, singled out, that's incredibly threatening.
Yeah. So is a little competitiveness good, but can there be too much?
I don't think so.
No.
No, so that's the point. So there is this question that if you're super competitive, do you automatically become a cheater, right?
Right.
Or a jerk.
Right, or a poor loser.
Or a poor loser.
Or as you say, that's no different than a poor winner. It's just...
So what I try to describe is healthy competitive skills.
Yeah.
And in healthy competitive skills... If you're a surgeon, you're gonna like absolutely try to be the best surgeon you can be.
Right.
But it's you let it go that you're not the best player at the tennis club on the weekends. Right. You conserve your energy
for
the things
battles
that really matter. There are people who are hyper competitive, or we call in the book maladaptively competitive, because they have to win at everything. They don't conserve their energy,
right,
and that in some ways diffusing their competitive response.
That's really interesting. So it is okay to be extraordinarily competitive, but pick where you are. Make it important in a certain area, but not throughout your life.
Right. And another competitive skill that's important is to be able to turn it off.
Right.
You know, we don't have a little battle here. You've been covering the tech industry for, you know, longer than I have, and we're not like jarring with each other. You know, like there's environments where you need to turn off your competitiveness.
Right.
And
right,
if you don't have that, you don't have healthy competitive skills.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I always thought, I mean, it's almost, you have to have two minds. If you're playing a game, and I play a lot of chess, so that's a good example for me. You have to want to win. You have to want to beat the other guy. But you also have to recognize that there's no game without the other guy.
Right.
That you're really in cooperation as much as you are in competition.
You collaborate and compete at the same time. Or in a workplace situation, most of us do work on teams.
Right.
And on a team, you collaborate with your team to compete with the other teams out there, right?
Right.
You
right.
compete and collaborate at the same time. And that's why I said testosterone was one of the main hormones of both competition and collaboration. They're wired together to do the both at the same time. We always agree on the rules when we have to compete.
Do you ever think about how these are evolutionary adaptations? Where these things came from?
Yeah, well, it's pretty straightforward.
Hunter gatherers, hunters have to work in a team together, right?
Right, right, and especially played a part in understanding some of the male female average differences in competitive style, where evolutionists would argue that men needed to bond together really quickly, come together as a team very quickly, and take enormous risk their life to do things.
Right, to hunt the mastodon.
Yeah, or go up against another tribe.
Right.
And women evolved some subtle biological, physiological mechanisms that allowed them to be able to take less risk. I'm not talking about all women. I'm just talking about...
Yeah, this is a...
It's a tricky talk.
Ashley, you'll get in trouble with Ashley, so...
I don't get in trouble with Ashley. We can do this. We can just cover this right now. Like, we can talk about, like, women entrepreneurs and who's likely to be a female entrepreneur, and there's some really interesting science to that transcends.
Tell me about that.
Gender. Okay, so policy...
So, again, it's generalizations.
You can make generalizations about male and female differences,
right,
which do exist.
Right.
Okay, but with separate from gender, one of the most interesting things is, and people watching this can do this, but if I were to look at the palm of my right hand, and it always needs to be the right hand, you look at how long is your...
Even if you're a lefty?
Yeah, even
okay.
If you're lefty. So if you look at the length of your index finger and you look at the length of your ring finger.
Yeah.
Now, we're looking for people who have a longer ring finger than index.
Oh, I lose.
Okay, so I'm one of those people. My ring finger's longer than my
look
index
at that.
Finger. Okay?
What a weird hand you have.
Okay, yeah. So the very
Let's
same
Let's see your
thing,
hand, Lisa.
The very same thing that makes the fingers lengthen in our mom's womb when we're developing is the thing that changes how the hypothalamus in the preliminary limbic brain gets organized. It affects cell migration in the hypothalamus. As a result, the relative finger length is actually a marker for orientation towards risk-taking And so there's a scholar at a Northwestern. She studies University of Chicago MBAs.
Okay.
And by looking at their fingers and also just taking a little saliva and doing a couple hormone tests, she can predict whether they're going to go into high finance and high tech.
High risk.
Or go into a conservative, safe, Midwest, you know, accounting or corporate job.
Right.
And she can really well predict who's going where based on these biometrics. They also did another scholar.
So I'm a low-risk kind of guy. You're a high-risk kind of guy.
Well, just saw the looks of it. Your ring finger looks a little bit longer than your index finger there. It doesn't take much.
Oh, my index finger. I was looking at my middle finger. Right. Middle finger is always longer.
No.
No. My ring finger is longer than my index.
That's
so it's a risk. But is it, if it's like really big, is that more risky?
Yes. Yeah.
And so, Lisa, let me see. She runs this business. She's the entrepreneur. She's a woman. This is gender neutral, right? Yeah, okay.
Right, so one-third of women are, like me, going to have a longer ring finger than index finger. And they're...
So you're a small minority, then?
Well, two-thirds of men are going to have that pattern.
And more
one-third
common
of
men.
Women. But, okay. Like, in Italy, they looked at a study of 3,000 entrepreneurs in Italy. Yeah. Not tech entrepreneurs, but people of every sort of business.
But presumably risk-takers.
And they found absolutely that not only that finger-length ratio predicts the size of their company and the growth rate of their company. And so
if I'm Paul Graham, forget all the other metrics. Show me your hand, you young entrepreneur. Let's see.
Exactly. Throw out the resume. Let me see your hand. Yeah.
Wow. Is that why there are more men entrepreneurs than women?
Well, that's one possible reason, but we wouldn't, a whole lifetime experience
There's
certainly
other things
counts
too.
Yeah. I mean, but the science
we
does
don't give
say
women
that we
as
should
many
be
chances.
Seeing more than 4.3% of venture-funded companies founded by women. There's plenty, you know,
should
one-third of women are ready for this,
yep.
And they're only up 4.3%. So there's something else blocking them for sure.
I love this. This is such great stuff. We're talking to Poe Bronson, the author, along with Ashley Merriman, of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. We should probably say this. Just because your ring finger is the wrong length doesn't mean you don't have a shot.
No. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about one of many additive factors that work together.
But I'm happy to see that mine is longer. It makes me feel good about myself.
Yeah. Also in the book, we write about another thing that kind of freaks people out. It's called this gene. It's the COMT gene.
Right.
It encodes the COMT enzyme, which is two types of enzymes that work in the front of the brain that clear dopamine. And the net result is that some people work really well. Their brains work best with no stress.
Right.
And some people actually need stress to work their best.
Yes.
So you have two different types, right?
Yes.
And it's been given the nickname the warrior-worrier gene.
Warrior-worrier.
And the idea was, and both genes are equally distributed in our population. The warrior gene is the one we share with primates, but the warrior gene is a reason it exists. It's popular now. It went from obviously being a mutation to now half of the gene pool. It's a successful. So people say, "Oh, I don't want." People who've heard about the book are like, "Oh, I don't. I'd rather be a warrior than a worrier." If my kid's a warrior, how can I turn her into a warrior?
Right.
You know, I'm like, there's a reason this is successful. It's giving you, without stress, a 10-point cognitive advantage, 10-point IQ advantage in a non-stressful situation.
Wow.
To have the warrior genes helps you plan in advance, anticipate future consequences, strategize. There's a lot of good things to being a warrior because you can worry about deep into the future in a way that a warrior maybe is more prone towards handling immediate short-term stress.
Right. So there's advantage to both, and it'd probably be useful to know which you were. I guess you probably already know if you think about it, right?
Most people kind of, when they think about it,
I'm suspicious.
I will say that half of all people are heterozygotes, so they have one of each gene. So they actually have both types of enzymes working in their brain, and they kind of come out somewhere in the middle on all these scores.
It'd be better to have one or the other, though, right? Because then you'd be really good at one of them.
Yeah, you'd have a real strength, yeah.
But always nice to have strengths. As an individual or team gets closer to completing its goal, their mental strategy and their motivation changes.
Yeah, so I was really interested in this in an education context. It's one of those little paradoxes.
See, I am the kind of person that I must be a finishing thing, but as soon as I get close to the goal, I go, I'm almost done, and I stop.
Right. And some people, as they get close to the goal,
they go.
The fact that it's really nearby, they get more and more excited and pumped up.
Yeah.
And but a lot of us, as they get close to that goal, it's like, gear it down, gear it down.
Yeah, I'm almost there.
You
relax.
Walk across the finish line, right?
Yeah. So is that a gene? Do we know what that is?
Oh, no. So it tends to be an orientation that people have developed over time.
An idea.
It's a psychology.
So you could change
basically.
That.
You can change that. But,
okay.
Or it's not, you know, it's not that it's easy to change. But what's interesting is how that same thing happens to us in different moments of life. That in moments, we have one style or the other. So in an education environment, at the beginning of a semester, when students are trying to gain a lot of new knowledge and they're into this sort of like adding things, they will score highest on a test if you start them at zero and say, I'm going to give you 20 questions. You get 1 point right. You get 1 point for every right answer.
Yeah.
They'll score the highest if you score them that way.
Right.
At the end of a semester, when they are focused on not forgetting all the stuff that they packed into their brain this semester, and they're like they're not trying to add anything new, just trying to like not forget stuff. They're in this other frame of mind. Literally different neural networks are activated. They're trying to avoid mistakes, trying to not forget things.
Oh, interesting.
And now they will be, because of that, the scoring system, they'll score higher if you say to them, you get 20 points, I will deduct 1 point for every wrong answer.
They become risk averse.
And that risk aversion, that risk orientation, that the scoring method fits their mentality, optimizes their performance.
Wow, that's interesting. Why is it better to focus on what didn't happen? This sounds like a warrior thing. Is this related? What's better to focus on what didn't happen than what did happen?
So
that's counterintuitive.
Well, maybe, but when I explain it, it's probably going to make more sense.
Okay.
So we all suffer losses. We all make mistakes, right? We all have to rebound from losses.
Right.
And the question is, what our minds generate all these thoughts, thinking about like what went wrong and what can we do about it,
right?
So
I think of that as somebody who's kind of worry.
It sounds like a form of worrying, but it's also a form of strategizing, and it's critical thinking. I mean, people need to do critical thinking.
You got to learn from your mistakes.
Right, so you have to think about them. So what the science says is that this whole spectrum between positive thinking and negative thinking is actually not very helpful.
Ah.
Make a difference between additive and subtractive thinking. Subtractive thinking is where you're thinking, you're dwelling on your mistakes, is what you did wrong that led to that mistake in performance. And what they show is that if you do that kind of subtractive thinking, thinking about what I wish I had not done, you don't improve your performance.
Okay.
But if you think about what you could have done but did not do.
Mm.
If you think about what you would do next time that you did not try that time, if you add new strategies to your arsenal of choices, people then tend to improve performance over time.
You know, they talk in Silicon Valley about how it's important to fail and fail fast and fail often, but it's actually, there's more to it. It's also how you treat your failure and what you learn from it. And if you do it additively, you'll be more likely to succeed in the next.
You know, I think people say that, but then they don't finish through. Why? Why is that important? People they say that very sentence, and then they kind of stop. You know, like, there's a really important reasons to lose and lose fast. Well, the most important one is not this little tactical. The most important one is that to be entrepreneurial means to take risks.
Right.
And to take risks, you have to be not concerned
about
with
the
downside.
Yeah.
So you need to have had those failures and learned, it doesn't hurt me, I'm okay, I'm not scared of it.
Right.
And if you're not... To compete means to take risks ordinarily constrained by fear, okay? And if you are afraid of losing, you don't take risks in the first place.
Right.
So you need to have learned to lose and snap out of it and snap back from it in order to have the mindset where you are free to take big risks.
Right.
Silicon Valley is focused on taking risks, but big risks.
I didn't die. So let's do it again.
Right. Try it again. Yeah.
Maybe this time it'll work.
Right.
Why is it better to be, why is it the best orchestras, it's maybe not better, but why is it the best orchestras have the most miserable musicians?
Well, so this goes to the science of teams. Yeah. And it's actually true. So it sounds like a line, but the scholar studies the world's orchestras and the finest in the world. And he finds, and what their interpersonal relations are like off stage. And he finds that when it's the grand opera on stage, it's a soap opera on stage.
Oh, yeah. That's how you feel like it is.
If you think about it, it makes sense. So people who have spent their lives trying to be a soloist and don't quite make it end up in a choir or in a symphony or an orchestra,
or the core,
where they have to sound exactly the same,
right,
as there's a little hierarchy. There's first chair, second chair.
But
you thought you were going to be someone who stood out from the crowd.
It's the same in the ballet.
Just sound alike as everybody else, and that drives them crazy.
Miserable. But they're the most talented musicians.
They have the most successful.
They were almost.
Yeah, but we use that soloists as a story to show that actually hierarchy within a team, role clarification, division of labor within a team actually makes it far more productive. You know, 62% of software projects are delivered late, 49% are over budget.
Right.
And all these things are developed on teams.
Yeah.
And the science,
and we even know this is going to happen.
Yeah. We do ahead of time, right?
Right.
Right. And there's a big haircut on the deadline and everything.
Right.
You know, but what the science is saying is most of our teams are too big. They're saying teams need to be as small as possible, as humanly possible, to get the job done. Because then everybody is really invested and involved. And coordinating team. Think of when you're on a team, all the emails that go back and
forth.
It's
very hard, yeah.
And that eats up 40% of productivity,
right,
they say. So this a team of six people has 15 interpersonal connections. And that's a lot of communication going on. You just add two people to that team, you know, like, hey, let's
geometric,
put a couple more people on that team.
Yeah.
They might have a good opinion.
No,
who knows how they can
no
help. You know, you go from 15 connections to 28 connections.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go from losing 20% productivity organizing to 40%.
That's the mythical man month.
Yeah.
That's what they talk about. Yeah.
Right.
So presumably, if you wanted to, you could read this book and kind of figure out how to be better at how to be more successful.
Yes. Or what I like to say is that the book does not say that here's only one way to be successful.
No, not at all.
Here's the one competitive style that you should
do. Not at all, yeah.
It shows you all these hidden factors, and I hope it helps different people understand what are these hidden factors and what are the circumstances under which they would personally compete the best.
Figure out what your type is.
What your type is, and all different types, all different variables are playing off each other and interacting.
Yeah.
And you want to figure out what helps you, you know, succeed, what helps you achieve your goals. And there, you know, you can be a warrior, or you can be a warrior. You can have long fingers or short fingers, you know.
Still succeed.
Yeah.
What are some other things? What are some other traits that you want to look for?
Well, in terms of variables that affect people's competitive styles.
Yeah.
So,
the difference, what you talk about, the difference between winning and not losing.
Right. So, some people are really focused on actually being the winner, and that is their orientation.
Right.
Second place to them is like losing.
Right.
Right. Other people just like don't want to be on the bottom of the pile.
Right.
That is.
I'd
really
be happy not
motivation
to lose.
Yeah. To not lose.
See,
branded,
I want to win.
You really
I want to be number one.
You want to be number one.
Number two is just the first loser.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm a little more of like I need to be in the. In the upper pack. I never needed to be the top guy.
Right.
But I always wanted to be in that upper hanging.
So if you know that about yourself, does that change how you will compete in the world?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you help you recognize yourself and you recognize your own instinct.
Right.
And sometimes if someone like you who really focused on, I really feel like I need to be on top.
Right.
Can be in situations where that may not be healthy exactly right then because you can't quite get there just then.
Right.
So just recognizing about yourself helps you tame some of that energy.
I'm going to feel like a failure, but that's just the best that's going to be possible here, and maybe it's not so bad to be number two or number three.
But, you know, and then on the other side, you know, people who really don't want to be a loser, you can harness that. They may not have the winner's mentality.
Right.
But the fact that you can shame them easily and scare them that you're going to be one of those 10% cut by GE, you know, you're going to be on the bottom of the pile.
Oh, and no, I don't want to be a loser.
If you talk to them about that threat, then they will really energize themselves. You know, what I think the book is about is like, look, we have no trouble saying companies need to be competitive, countries need to be competitive, sports need to be competitive.
Right.
When it comes to individual people being competitive, we go, okay, well, that sounds, sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's a bad thing.
Right.
But we also would say that a lot of people, you know, your company is competing, but are you competing? Do you feel that competitive edge on a day-to-day basis?
Right.
Or are you just mailing it in, you know?
I think a lot of people don't like to feel competitive. They don't want to be competitive.
And knowing when to turn the stress up and when to turn the stress off is important.
It's stressful for them.
You know, one of the shocking things to me was studies of elite competitive schools. And you were mentioning this because I went to Lakeside School.
Absolutely, right? One of them.
So the science is saying, and this is science out of the American South of charter schools, out of Britain, out of China, and out of Trinidad and Tobago. And what they show is that boys in highly elite competitive schools, if they're on top, they do great. But if they're sort of down on the bottom, even though they're in a great school with great resources,
they're still ahead of everybody
else,
right?
Well, but they would often do better to be in a less competitive environment.
Right.
While girls tend to do uniformly well in these highly competitive markets, they ask for help. But what's going on is that the girls can turn their constantly comparing themselves to others, at least academically, off. While the boys, first, they have overconfidence going to those schools in the first place. Boys always think that they're better than they are at stuff, and it gets them. and science backs me up.
By the way,
this.
No revelation to women,
right? And then they're surprised when they get into these schools, but also just that the constantly comparing themselves to the other boys there drags them down. We tell stories out of the Air Force Academy demonstrating this as well, this phenomenon, and. What it suggests is not that you have to pull your kids out of elite competitive schools. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm trying to say is that turning off your own tendency to relentlessly compare yourself to others can be too stressful and debilitating that it hampers performance. So I go back to that notion of a healthy competitive skill is sometimes to turn it down.
Right.
Yeah.
The book is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, and it's fun to read because you have so many case studies, so many examples, and every page you go, oh, wow, that's great. I like that kind of book.
Thanks, man.
Really wonderful. What are you going to work on next?
Don't know. I'm so we've discovered our competitive styles, and I have learned. I like short, intense competitions.
Uh-huh.
I like to get under your skin, and then when it's over, hug it out, have a beer, and rest and recuperate. So when this is done, I'm going to rest and recuperate and germinate some new thing.
Is Ashley in it for the long run?
She is a very different style. She's like every day. Like writing a book is a 3-year project.
I know.
9 o'clock
Amazing.
In the morning, she calls me from L.A. She's ready to work, you know, and she's like – And she likes
to work. Do you work together on the phone as you're writing, or
not as we're writing? But we will read stuff and hammer, discuss it at length, and then we'll both go try to write something, and then we'll turn off the phones for a few hours, and then call each other back.
How did you come to this collaborative style? Because it's not how you started.
No, I mean, it was really that I grew up playing team sports, and being a writer was a solo effort.
It's very solo for most.
And I built in San Francisco with my friends this writer's grotto, this cooperative.
Oh, the grotto, yeah.
So just so we could hang around other writers.
Yeah.
But I don't work with those other writers.
Right.
And that they would be the supportive community. So I wouldn't be so lonely. But after 5 books, I was a little like, you know, doing this alone is hard. And Ashley and I started blocking together, and it was picked up by Time. And I've realized this is kind of like
a
team.
To do it.
It's
yeah.
like we're a team, and like this is kind of fun, and like working. And I thought I'll work as a team for a while and bring that team energy that
That's
I always
neat.
Had, you know, to that.
So is that why you started the Grotto?
Yeah, very much so. You know, writers have normally they think about the big turning point or jumping point in their life is the getting that first book published or the first magazine story published, right?
Right.
But the real challenge they have is quitting your day job and trying to make a living at
it.
And so we formed the Grotto back in 94, Ethan Kane and Ethan Waters and I, because we were all at that point. We were quitting our jobs and making the jump to try and do that, and wanted a support structure for working professional writers. It's now, we're down near South Park at 2nd and Bryant. We got
$75 a month.
Yeah.
You get to hang out.
That's right.
Great lunch.
Well, lunch isn't free. You got to pay for it.
But it's
not
so
Google
good.
Or
it sounds awesome.
Yeah.
You know? It sounds, and you have fellows, right? So there's you.
Yeah, we scholarship.
That's really great.
Emerging writers. We have like 85 writers there. We teach 3 classes a night.
It's legendary, actually.
But we support each other. We have a culture where we support each other, and we don't try to tear each other down.
That's neat.
Share resources and agents and stuff. But in the end, when the words hit the page, we are all alone at that point.
And a little competitiveness, then, is not so bad.
Well, some of us discussed, should be more competitive within the grotto.
Because it's very cooperative, right?
Yeah. It is. It's a very cooperative culture that we built, but maybe leaning a little too hard in that direction.
Well, they could always read this book, Top Dog. Poe, it's been so great to meet you and spend some time talking. I'm a big fan from the novels. And then the stuff that you've done with the Ashley Nurture, it's Nurture Shock, right?
Yeah, Nurture Shock.
And then this new one, The Top Dog, is really just fascinating reading.
Thanks, so, man.
Thank
really
you for coming
it.
In. Appreciate it. Right. We do Triangulation every Wednesday, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC on twit.tv. And I invite you to watch live because I follow the chat room and I look for ideas and questions there. And it's always great to have you here live. But if you can't, don't worry. On-demand audio and video always available after the fact. As we approach our 100th show, that means there's, you know, 93 great, interesting people that every single show is stimulating and fascinating. So go back through the archives. I'm sure you'll find something to listen to. And then just keep coming back and listening to more. In fact, if you subscribe in iTunes or one of your other favorite podcatchers, Instacast, Dogcatcher, whatever, you make sure you don't miss an episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.